Hello and welcome to the official podcast of Palate Exposure, featuring Ilona Thompson, a podcast for those seeking the ultimate in wine, food, and travel. Each week, she interviews winemakers, chefs, celebrities, and a variety of guests that shape the way we enjoy life.
Hello, Ilona Thompson with Palate Exposure. I'm here in beautiful Napa Valley with Jeff Smith, whose wines I admired for a long time, and who is a really formidable figure in Napa, not just because of his really beautiful brand, Hourglass, and I mean, it is one of my favorite wines of all time, but also the fact that he has a really interesting backstory. There's music involved in that story. So he's gonna tell us all about his background and his current project and his passions. And we'll start at the very beginning. We'll start with where were you born? Where did you grow up?
Well, thanks for taking some time to come up and interview me. It's a great pleasure to do this. And I had this incredibly lucky and awesome childhood of being able to grow up in Napa Valley, which is relatively unusual thing. My family had moved to the little town of St. Helena in 1964 when I was a year old.
Oh my God.
Yeah, isn't that wild?
That is so crazy. I literally don't know of anybody else in the vintner community that I've interviewed that literally grew up here.
There are really very few. Obviously, Mondavis were here, right? before we were. In effect, when they were here, their name was pronounced Mondavi.
little known fact,
it wasn't until Robert left the family business and changed the pronunciation of his name out of protest to some business dealings they had. But there really weren't very many wine families here. So my father moved the family here in 64 just because he was captivated by the physical beauty of Napa Valley. He had been in the radio and television business in the Bay Area, living kind of the Mad Men lifestyle and the three martini lunch sort of thing, and doing corporate work in radio and television, and just got kind of burnt out on it and wanted a whole different lifestyle change. And I'm the baby of five, so he packed up the family of five and moved us here to Napa Valley, which was a really crazy thing to do at that point. It's hard to imagine Napa in the 60s and 70s and even into the 80s. It was a really sleepy ag town, and wine was not the predominant business here. It wasn't until many years later that the wine business exploded. When we were here, it was sort of a multi-agriculture that grapes were a very, very small part of. But my father, he had an eye for really beautiful things, and Napa got in his soul. It captivated him. We actually owned some property over in Dry Creek, and we would drive through Napa to get to that ranch, and we'd go up there on the weekends and stuff like that. And it was Dad's little, you know, sort of project. But every time we would drive through Napa, he was just like, "Ah, this place is stunningly beautiful." So with no there were no radio and television companies here, so he moved here like, "I'm just going to leave that all behind and I'm going to reinvent myself." And he always wanted to be an entrepreneur. So he thought, well, listen, populations are going to move north of the Bay Area. If I could just get ahead of the population growth and maybe get into a field of work that that could take advantage of that, maybe this will work out. And so he made this transition into real estate development and got his broker's license, started brokering deals and started developing properties and so forth. And it was a real struggle the first handful of years. And it wasn't really until probably 66 that he started to become economically viable. So there was a few years there where we were kind of biting our nails, and or I would say my mom was biting her nails. I was too young to know. But slowly but surely, they kind of cobbled together an existence, and it was bucolic and it was beautiful. And so, you know, I have these great memories of a kid of, you know, my dad, who now had time in his life. You know, he'd take me to school every morning and we'd go find a tractor to get on, and he'd throw me on a tractor and we'd drive around, or or we'd go to the park and we'd go, you know, play in the swing sets and all that kind of stuff. And so I really had this focus time with my dad, which was really cool. And I think that's probably what set the entrepreneurial hook, is that time that I had with him very early on. So the story kind of winds through from there. And I, you know, I'm a K-12 St. Helena public school kid. And we really began to see the transformation of Napa really after the Judgment of Paris tasting happened in 1976. That was a pivot moment for sure. And now all of a sudden there are people with foreign accents traipsing through the valley, and you could tell something was changing, something was afoot. And these new energies were coming into the valley, and new people were moving to the valley, and they were picking up the bones of this industry that had been scattered about by Prohibition. So Napa had a very vibrant wine community in the mid-1800s to 1919. There were 200 wineries here in 1919. And then Prohibition brings a hammer down, and almost all of them are wiped off the face of the planet. A handful of them made it through Prohibition, making sacramental wine for the Catholic Church, and a couple bootleggers, but the industry as we knew it was laid waste. And all of the bones of that industry were kind of scattered about, unorganized, you know, ghost wineries, fallow land that once had been planted, you know, decrepit vineyards that were, you know, overgrown and so forth. And so after the Judgment of Paris, you started seeing families kind of drifting into the community and picking up the bones of this industry and reorganizing them. And that was really fascinating.
I just want to focus on that moment for a second, because Judgment of Paris is widely viewed as an international coup, which it was. Mm,
for sure.
However, what you describe me is that it made a monumental difference in the Napa community, and Napa we know today would have never have happened without it. Is that a true statement or not?
Yeah, there are a lot of people that look at those pivot moments of, you know, what put Napa on the map. Was it Robert Mondavi? Robert mm-hmm. Mondavi gets a lot of credit as being the godfather of Napa, and he deserves a lot of credit for that. Would Napa have happened without him? I think so. Mm-hmm. Would Napa have happened without the Judgment of Paris? I think so. This is one of the truly great growing regions for wine in the world. And that would have happened, I think, with or without one of these seminal moments or seminal individuals. It may have taken longer. The arc may have been different. The varietal plantings may have been different. There are a lot of ways that could have gone. But I think at the end of the day, if America was going to discover a food and wine culture, Napa was going to play a role regardless of who were the generators of that or what the seminal moments were.
Really interesting. You know, I'm just thinking of this just awful pause button that Prohibition delivered. And yet, like you said, viticulture, viniculture was quite robust. And what Napa would have looked like if that hasn't happened, you know, nobody knows. I'm sure that it would have been, the pace would have been much more accelerated, and perhaps it's for better or for worse. Like you said, you know, maybe varietally it would have looked different. What do you think?
You know, that's actually, you bring up a good point, and I'm gonna maybe rephrase my earlier comment in the sense that I think the we have all of these different seminal moments in the evolution of Napa. The one that I think is maybe the most important and one that's the least talked about is the 1968 Ag Preserve legislation that was passed. This was the first time in American history that zoning laws were recrafted based on agricultural lines and agricultural purposes. And what that regulation did was it locked in the better part of the Napa floor and all of the hillsides and watersheds into agricultural purposes. So there was a limit on development if it didn't have an agricultural component to it. So that piece may be, if without that piece, maybe the trajectory of Napa follows the trajectory of Silicon Valley, for example.
Exactly, that's what I was thinking.
So Silicon Valley, as you know, was an ag community just like Napa was. And there, the Napa Valley Vintners has this fantastic video or slide presentation where they show a picture of Napa and a picture of Sunnyvale circa, you know, in the mid-50s or something like that. And the Napa picture is vineyards and the Sunnyvale picture is an orchard. And then you slide through to 2005 or whenever the next picture is, and that same vineyard is there and the orchard in Sunnyvale is now a shopping mall. So without the 1968 regulations and the zoning changes, maybe Napa doesn't become a world-class wine growing region. Maybe it becomes a spillover outgrowth of the Bay Area that's now shopping malls and housing developments and so forth.
And that's really scary but easy to imagine, because this is such a beautiful valley. It would have been developed to an nth degree.
People would have come here for the same reasons that my father came here, because it was so physically compelling.
Yeah.
They would have, and especially as populations expand and move north, as they did. My dad was right about that.
Yes.
And so development, the developmental pressures without the ag preserve may have forced out the growth of the wine industry. Because the growth of the wine industry took time, and development may have been at a faster pace.
So really, as we think about Napa history, those seminal moments, as you referred to them, would be Mondavi, Judgment of Paris, and the Ag Preserve. That has to be mentioned in the same
place. Yeah, those are three, certainly three really, really important elements. There are a host of others that played maybe a stronger or lesser role depending upon what they were. But if you said, you know, pick three things that had the biggest imprint on modern Napa as you know it today, I would say those would be the three that really jumped to my mind.
Well, you're the consummate insider. You literally grew up and watched it happen in real time. So that's quite valuable that that's how you identify it. So there you were in this really most would consider a paradise of sorts. Your dad clearly was a visionary. What's happening as you're growing up? Do you have ambitions to...
It was a great childhood. Yeah. You know, I didn't know it really at the time, but from the perspective of wine, which, you know, we'll get to that segment of my story, but from the perspective of growing up in what was becoming this burgeoning wine community, I grew up around the dinner table of so many of these new families who moved into the valley to pick up the bones of this industry and reorganize them. And it was around those dinner table conversations that the hook was set for me. As I said, I didn't know it then. For example, sitting around the dinner table at Schramsberg. You know, Schramsberg was basically my second home growing up. I was the same age as the middle brother of the three Davies brothers. And so I, you know, sort of joke that I became the fourth Davies brother, you know, cause I was just there all the time. And
so cool.
Sitting around listening to the trials and tribulations of Jack and Jamie Davies and how they moved here in 1966. They were 2 years behind us. Maybe they moved here in 65. I think 66 was their first vintage, but they probably landed here around 65. So they were a year or two behind us, whatever. But you think about the balls that took, you know, so here they're going to come to Napa Valley. Jack had a fantastic job as a corporate executive in Southern California. Jamie had a thriving art business. They were very successful, and they're going to throw all of that away and move to Napa Valley on a whim and somehow create sparkling wine or champagne that was going to rival the French. I mean, who the hell thought that way? That's crazy. But that's how they thought. And they executed that vision.
Indeed.
It was just an enormously risky thing to do. And there's probably some naivete, you know, mixed in there, because if they'd really known what they were up against, they would never have done it. But they did, and I got a chance to, you know, be around people like that. I had the chance to work at Robert Mondavi in the late 80s when Robert was very active in the business, and I learned his mindset on culture and how he wanted his business run. And he had a very open source mindset, very, very progressive California, long before Silicon Valley had this, you know, open source mentality. His vision was that information ruled and that no one of us was strong enough or big enough to actually make an appellation work. So we had to work collectively. And in order to do that, Robert Mondavi Winery became the launch pad that launched so many of us off onto other threads of this industry. And he encouraged that. Very, very unusual. Really unusual. So I got a chance to grow up around people like that.
Best mentors ever, may I just say?
For sure.
I mean, you can't buy, I mean, that sounds so trite. But where do you get that kind of exposure on a regular basis in that context? That's unprecedented.
You know, if you work at Microsoft, you don't get to hang out with Bill Gates. You know, if you're working at Apple, you probably weren't rubbing shoulders with Steve Jobs. But I had one of the lowest level jobs at Mondavi, and Robert Mondavi was accessible to me. I remember on numerous occasions setting up tastings for him, and he would taste with whoever he's tasting, and then he'd show them to the door, and he'd come back. He'd say, "Jeff, what do you think about these wines? Talk to me about this." I remember very vividly setting up a tasting of 82 First Growths for him. I can't remember what writer it was. Maybe it might have been Parker. Mm-hmm. I wasn't at that point. I was probably 20 at that point. And so I certainly wasn't going down the path of wine at that particular point. This was just a job I had to, you know, pay rent. And so anyway, I set up this tasting for him, and he shows the reviewer to the door, and he comes back in. He's super excited. He's like, "Jeff, you know, what do you think about, you know, we have the 5 first growths here, and we have the Robert Mondavi Reserve, and we have the Opus 1. What do you think of all of these wines?" And he wasn't like, "Yeah, our wines are better than theirs." He was just like a kid in a candy store. He's like, tell me what you think of these wines." I'm like, "Why do you care about what some 20-year-old, you know, peon thinks about these wines?" But it mattered to him. And I said, "Well, my favorite is the 82 Margaux." And he goes, "Ah, great choice. Those sandy soils, the elegance, the purity, there's power, but there's elegance and purity." And then he just went off and he broke the wine down. And I'm just like, "Whoa, this is cool. Oh, who is this guy?" Like, and I think the hook was set, you know, in those little encounters with Robert Mondavi and with Jack Davies and with, you know, God, the list goes on and on and on. So it was an amazing childhood to have been around that.
You're describing such a communal spirit that I think all of us are so drawn to. Obviously, it was a small community when your family first came here, but it was a very strong and tightly knit one, wasn't it?
For sure. Yeah, and the core DNA of Napa is a collective mindset. That's changed a bit over the years, but it's still there. And Robert Mondavi, I think, deserves a lot of the credit for establishing that based on his actions and based on how he set the culture of Robert Mondavi Winery in the early days and how that culture spread out. So, you know, it was kind of like Mondavi U. That was the training ground and the educational ground for so many people who earned their early chops and then went on to do other things. And Robert was incredibly supportive of you taking that knowledge and going off and doing your own thing and going and being successful, because he knew that if you were successful, that was going to be one more step in putting Napa on the map.
You know, his way of branding, if you will, to me, is one of the most important messages that exist in any business world. As I travel, I often get questions about Napa, and there's quite a few misconceptions because it's such a successful,
right,
you know, economically, commercially, and renowned worldwide for the quality of the wines. I mean, I don't know if it's just misinformation or maybe a little jealousy or resentment, whatever the underlying factors are. A lot of the comments center on how pricey, how inaccessible Napa Valley is. And that's not the Napa that I know. And I really wanted to zero in on your comments because, again, the inside or the capital I over here, I just want to highlight that that communal spirit that Mondavi established, that tide lifts all boats, that yep. spirit of generosity and facilitating others, building the brand of Napa, the gracious soul that yeah. he was, that it's alive today. You say it is, right?
For sure. It's here. It's here in spades. It may get a little glossed over. You know, Napa has become... it's become a world-renowned growing region with all that goes with that, the good, the bad, the ugly. And it's all here. And there are misconceptions about Napa, but some of them are founded in things that are here. But it's not the complete story. Mm-hmm. And what I find fascinating about Napa is, and this for a whole generation of new like sommeliers and people coming into the wine trade, this is the Napa that I want them to come and experience and learn. Napa is in many respects just an outgrowth of the culture that is Northern California. So for example, Silicon Valley and this open source mentality and so forth, that's alive here as well. That's a cultural phenomenon that is a greater cultural phenomenon of Northern California. And so what is Napa? Napa is like an open source experiment that's happening in live time that if you choose to engage with, you can come and leaf through the pages of that book, and you can go as deep as you want. It's all open for you to come and check out. And I don't think that there's really any other place like that in the world for wine. Mm-hmm. And I don't think there's any place like that in the world for tech either, or for a whole bunch of other things. And that's why, you know, San Francisco is such an amazing city, is that it has this open culture, and you can come and you can experiment and you can... you know, learn about yourself, and there aren't a whole lot of rules and regulations that kind of bind everybody together, and it's open. So Napa is just an outgrowth of that cultural experience. And if you want to go deep, you can come here and go deep, and nobody's going to stop you.
You know, that is such a healthy perspective. First of all, I've never thought of it that way, so thank you. But the other piece is that there's so many conversations that dominate, such as globalization, homogeneity, mm-hmm. Corporate, you know, invasions.
Right.
But that's not a complete story at all.
Well, I think it's 87% of Napa wineries are family owned.
That's good. That's good to hear.
Yeah. I mean, listen, the corporate element is here. And that's not all bad either.
No.
And I think that we're probably going to see that accelerate a bit. It's going to be a really interesting period over the course of the next 5 to 10 years as the generation one entrepreneurs who move their families here to do this mm-hmm. begin to pass off. And as they pass away, generation two is... First of all, they have to have the interest and the desire to want to take over the family business, and there'll be a bunch who don't want to do that. So those, you know, wineries will probably be sold. And then of the ones that do and are qualified to do it, then you have to deal with the whole estate tax issue, which,
yes.
if you consider that Generation One bought in the 70s and 80s. Let's say they bought in when my family bought in. We bought the Hourglass estate in 1976. We paid $20,000 for 6 acres.
There's no wow big enough.
I mean, think of that. And so I don't know what the valuation is now, but it's a hell of a lot more than $20,000. So now Generation One passes on, and the federal government's knocking at your door saying, hey, we want our 50% inheritance tax, and you don't have the cash to pay the capital gain differential between what Generation One bought that land for and what now Generation Two has to pay in capital gains. If you don't have the cash to be able to do that, then you're out. So it's going to be an interesting shell game of shuffle as that starts to play itself out over the next 5 to 10 years.
So if we're losing this iteration of agriculture as a family owned to the extent that we have now that we enjoy, then thank your local politician. Good to know that.
Yeah, well, I usually leave my politics at the door when I'm talking business, but I will say that some changes recently in the estate tax laws have radically benefited small family businesses in Napa Valley. And that will help. That will help some.
No, I love hearing that. I mean, you know, you're absolutely right. Politics are not part of this type of discussions for me either. But I mean, it seeps insofar that if it affects the livelihood of this community in particular, and others, of course, this is agricultural land. And a lot of us have vested interest in preserving it, even people in the peripheral. I mean, I'm a media member. I don't live in Napa Valley. I come here and live vicariously through you guys. But I realize the importance of it. And I understand that in order for me to keep coming back here and have these discussions, other things have to take place to facilitate that does not put a chokehold on this phenomenon, on this. Like you said, this is a very special place on Earth.
I mean, you think about it, Napa. I like to actually think about it really as a national treasure. Like how many wine growing regions of this caliber are there in the world? Like not many. Mm-hmm. I would say that Napa ranks in the top 3 or 4 or 5 of the greatest wine growing regions in the Napa. In the world.
Yeah.
And that's a beautiful thing. And right now, that's safeguarded by family wineries.
Exactly. You nailed it. I mean, when I first came here, I was awestruck, and that hasn't gone away. Every time I come here, I still have the same sentiment. And the fact that you are, in fact, stewards of this treasure.
Yeah.
I just really always root for supporting it and not compromising it in any way.
Yeah, it does need to be protected and preserved. And fortunately, we've got organizations like the Napa Valley Vintners and so forth that are really good about trying to carry forward Robert Mondavi's visions and ideas, and not just Robert Mondavi's, but a whole host of visionary winemakers and businessmen and so forth that have seen the value of keeping things small and keeping things family oriented and keeping everybody aligned along the same ideas that we are stewards. We have to protect this place. It's an awe-inspiring thing when you think about your responsibility as a landowner here, and we have to work collectively to protect this place. And it would be an absolute shame if we fumbled that ball.
Oh, I absolutely agree. I mean, I think it's a generational project, and you have to think in terms of 50 years, 100 years, and not
right.
5 or 10.
For sure.
And that's an awesome responsibility, and I'm sure that there's corresponding pressure.
The conclusion of this interview can be found in the next podcast, already available for your download. Thanks again for tuning in to the official podcast of Palate Exposure, featuring Ilona Thompson.